This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanasan with Numa Lim in the studio this morning. Now, before we get into our main story, in half an hour, we've got The Breakfast Grill, where Wong Xiaoning will be speaking with Dato' Lim Su Huat, Executive Chairman of Asia File Corp Berhad. Noel, what's happening? What's going to be the theme here?
Yeah, so Roshan, do you or have you used ABBA files? ABBA files?
I feel like this is going to define my generation, but I think so. I'm pretty sure I've seen them in my household. I probably used them
or perhaps
ages
your
ago?
Parents or your grandparents.
Yeah, but I can almost see ABBA on some files in my house right now. But yeah.
Yeah, so we're speaking, or rather Wong Xiaoning will be speaking to Asia File Corporation. They're based in Penang and they are the stationery group behind this brand. And apparently this brand is a big player in the UK and several parts of Europe. So I think some of the questions that she will be exploring with Dato' Lim are how will work from home and environmentally friendly trends affect the company and the stationery industry as a whole? Is the business facing a structural decline, and will their diversification plans into consumer and footwear products be a solution?
Interesting, very existential questions there. Wong Xiaoning will be discussing all this and more with Dato' Lim in about half an hour. But right now, let's take a look at what's happening in the US with regards to infrastructure spending. Now, the cold weather conditions that had crippled Texas energy and water infrastructure last week, causing the recent blackout, it's put a spotlight on the dire state of US infrastructure and the urgent need for federal investment.
Yeah, so, you know, fancy that, right? You would think US, first world country. Anyway, the US is notorious for its aging infrastructure networks, which are dangerously overstretched in capacity. In 2017, the American Society of Civil Engineers, for example, gave U.S. infrastructure a D-plus grade, meaning that the conditions were mostly below standard, exhibiting significant deterioration with a strong risk of failure.
That sounds like an almost failing grade at that point, really. And they estimated the infrastructure gap required was $2 trillion in investment by 2025. Otherwise, it could cost the economy $4 trillion in GDP. However, although infrastructure is a bipartisan issue, it has been notoriously difficult to pass spending on this. Some experts argue that the pandemic provides an opportunity for infrastructure spending to be prioritized. And President Joe Biden has pledged to spend around $2 trillion on infrastructure, including in the clean energy space. So I guess, can President Biden succeed where his predecessors have failed? For a perspective on this, we have on the line DJ Gribben, Senior Operating Partner at Stonepeak, a U.S. private equity firm investing in infrastructure. Thank you for joining us this morning, DJ. Let's start off this conversation with getting an understanding of the role that the U.S. federal government plays in infrastructure projects. How much control does it actually have?
That is an excellent question, and good morning, and thank you for inviting me to join you this morning. In short, the federal government does really have much control over infrastructure. The U.S. federal system results in almost all of our public infrastructure being owned at the state and local levels. The federal government owns about 6% of governmental infrastructure and funds about 25% of that infrastructure, but the key decisions in terms of what needs to be built, where it needs to be built, how is it funded, those decisions in the U.S. are almost always made at the state and local level. In addition, our market's incredibly fragmented. As an example, if you think about water infrastructure, we have in this country 52,000 community water systems. So if you went into an American household and turned on a tap in the kitchen, that water could be coming from one of 52,000 different entities. And that creates an interesting dynamic when the federal government wants to help something that's that fragmented and that diverse.
Why is the U.S. underinvested in infrastructure?
I think that that's an excellent question, and I would differentiate between governmental and non-governmental infrastructure. Obviously, our communications infrastructure does not suffer from a lack of investment. When you think about governmental infrastructure, so you're talking about water systems, highways, publicly owned utilities, there's downward pressure on prices. Nobody likes to increase utility rates. No politician likes to increase utility rates. No politician wants to raise taxes. And so the price of those services tends to be below the cost of building and maintaining them. And as a result, you under-maintain them, and the quality of those infrastructure assets degrades over time.
Former President Donald Trump tried to introduce several multi-billion dollar packages to boost infrastructure investment during his term. Maybe you could shed some light into why the Trump administration's plans failed to take off.
I'd be happy to do that. And just by way of background, so I was the U.S.'s first special assistant to the president for infrastructure, where I focused just on infrastructure. So my job inside of the White House was to put together that plan. There are a couple reasons why it was challenging to get that through. First, it is there's just a little bit of a lack of understanding about how the U.S. system worked. Early on, the thinking was that we could just, as the federal government, borrow funds at treasury rates, which, as you know, are extremely low, get together a list of projects, and then assign those funds to those projects based upon return on investment. The challenge with that is a couple-fold. One, return on investment analysis would result in all of those investments being made in urban areas and no money going to rural areas. And secondly, there's some negative externalities that come with federal investment that include state and local governments, who I mentioned before, provides the bulk of funding for these. State and local governments have a tendency to step back and not raise taxes or revenues if they think the federal funds are going to come. And then we learned during the global financial crisis and the response to that, where the federal government tried to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. And what ended up happening is that state and local governments would withdraw funds they had already planned to spend on the infrastructure and substitute federal funds instead. So it's quite complicated for the federal government to have a meaningful impact. In addition, the president's plan was quite transformative. So we haven't in this country fundamentally rethought infrastructure since the New Deal, which was in the 1930s, and the 1956 passage of the Federal Highway Act, which created our interstate system. And the plan that we put together was a 53-page outline. And while it was transformative and it was a great rethinking of the system, probably was just too technical for people to be absorbed. And then finally, the challenge we had was just one of communications, right? In typically what you do is you put together plans like these, you develop a message and they repeat that message over and over to help educate the public and their elected officials on why you want that plan. And I think there was a running joke here in the U.S. that we would have an infrastructure week where instead of talking about infrastructure, the president would fire the FBI director or have an impromptu conversation or race relations or do something else that would just make it difficult to get out the message of what the changes we were proposing and why.
So how much headway could Biden make in pushing for an infrastructure bill?
I think, so when you talk about infrastructure bill, I would break that up. I don't need to be too policy wonky into three categories. Infrastructure bill in terms of providing some immediate response to the pandemic, that I think there's a bit of opportunity there, but those funds would be mainly targeted towards operations costs and not building new things. Then we have a highway program here in the U.S. that's about to lapse, so that's likely. But when you talk about an overall comprehensive infrastructure bill that's taking into account, you know, renewables and housing and retrofitting buildings and schools and roads, that actually is quite hard. Our system is designed to slow the passage of ideas, so it's hard to get any good idea through. But a very broad, comprehensive package that includes lots of infrastructure asset classes and it tries to resolve climate change all in one bundle, that's a very, very heavy lift.
I guess I'm just curious, right? Earlier we mentioned that something as big as the New Deal or the Highway Act hasn't been done since then. What made those two, policy measures work versus and what has created the gap in ability to reach something like that since then?
Yeah, and so that's an excellent question. The New Deal was a response to the Depression as a way to get the economy going back in this country again. And the Highway Act was a response to just this horrible nature of the interstate system. We didn't have interstate system, just highways. It took Eisenhower a month to get across this country. And so he has committed himself to building a better thing. But realize when you're talking about funding for infrastructure, most of this funding is not federal, right? So you have states and localities that are currently investing more in infrastructure and improving the quality of infrastructure in the U.S. Los Angeles in 2016 passed a $120 billion bond initiative, and that initiative passed with over 70% of the vote. So I think sometimes people think that, you know, infrastructure funds come to the federal government from the federal government. We need more federal funding to fix the problem, when in reality, infrastructure funds come from state and local governments, and we really need state and local governments to be encouraged to invest more to fix this problem.
So what would encourage states to, you know, be to accelerate on infrastructure spending?
That is another excellent question. So a lot of them, since the last time we passed the gas tax in this country, we increased it federally, was 1993. Since then, 35 or so U.S. states have increased their state gas tax. So I think they're already seeing the need for additional investment. And you've seen a move from the gas tax to sales taxes and property taxes as a better way and more stable way to fund infrastructure. So one of the things the administration did in its plan was create an incentive program that where state and local governments, were they to raise taxes or raise revenues, that the federal government would provide incentive or a bonus for those types of activities.
DJ, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning. That was DJ Gribben, Senior Operating Partner at Stonepeak, a U.S. private equity firm investing in infrastructure. Noel, what were some of your key thoughts there?
Yeah, so I think very quickly, the communications infrastructure is quite robust in the U.S., but the utility side as well as some highways, that needs to be upgraded. So I think the question is whether Biden will be able to push through the infrastructure bill. I think much depends on the size and the breakdown, and that might be challenged by the Republicans. Then I guess if we had more time with DJ, I would like to ask, would the reconciliation process be an option for Biden to exercise to push through maybe some aspects of the bill? And I, as I understand, Biden can exercise that option up to 3 times a year using the reconciliation process.
Yes, definitely something to keep an eye on, because I think the Biden administration has put a lot of emphasis on this, as well as their new Green Deal, right? And we haven't seen something in the US as big as that since, as DJ mentioned, the original New Deal and, of course, the Highway Act both came in response to particular things, to address particular topics. Up next, though, we're going to be talking about the vaccine hesitancy with analysis from Dr. Helmi Haja Maidin, internal medicine specialist at Pantai Hospital Kuala Lumpur. So keep it here to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.